Vashishta, shall we start reading from some place? Sita, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Oh, I'm sorry, my microphone was muted. I was saying that just give me a moment. I'm trying to establish the link and the thought.
Yeah.
For that page 720. So this is essentially the link in the thought goes back to page 717. To that paragraph which begins, but where is the limit of effectuation in the evolutionary being self-becoming by self-exceeding? And this entire set of pages from there on to page 720 where we are. In fact, with these paragraphs reading from page 717 on, your window is establishing the links. In other words, what makes it possible for us to move from the physical to the other ranges of consciousness, because it relates to the integration part of ascent and integration that the human being has in himself all these other components of consciousness and can integrate them. So he's dealing with the entire subliminal consciousness over here, starting from the physical, then moving to the physical mind, the physical sensation, the life soul, the vital mentality. And here we are, the page 720 that we are talking about, we enter into the mind of pure intelligence. So, you want to start from the right there, page 720, the mind of pure intelligence, or do you think somebody can quickly read through from page 717, but where is the limit? There's one, two, and three paragraphs, three longish paragraphs, and one possibility would be for maybe three people to read those three paragraphs, just to bring us into this point.
Starting from 717?
Yeah, but where is the limit of effectuation in the evolutionary being self-becoming by self-exceeding?
Yeah, we can read it.
Okay. Before we start, can I just make a small request?
Sure.
This ascent and integration, like I was reading a commentary by MP Pandit, he was essentially saying this was the two central ideas that are being discussed are psychic realization and spiritual psychic ascent and spiritual ascent. These are the two main things that are talked about, and psychic is an individual one, and spiritual is more of a universal realization. That's what he was saying. Like, can you connect those thoughts and bring us, and then we can start maybe.
Actually, so far, he has talked more in terms of universal ascent and integration, in the sense that he has looked at the entire manifestation as a ladder of ascending consciousness, but has pointed out that each one of these, I mean, he's pointed out to a universal or a cosmic evolution following these two principles. One principle is the principle of ascent, and the other is the principle of integration. The principle of integration, hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
Hello?
Yes. Oh,
okay.
Yeah, we can hear you,
sorry,
but it seems like you have a
so
cold.
The principle of integration is, you know, what we call transformation, in the sense that every higher ascent establishes a form which includes within itself the lower rungs of consciousness and poses the challenge of how to modify these lower rungs of consciousness in the terms of that which it has ascended to. So that becomes the integration part. And this is all taken in a kind of a universal way. It is universal nature's evolution that he has discussed so far. But when we talk about the human being, this same process becomes individualized. And there, that individualized aspect or conscious, self-conscious aspect of this process is undertaken by the psychic being. So that is where this entire double process of ascent and integration, which may also be called evolution and transformation, you know,
we can't hear you anymore.
I'm sorry, actually,
I think I got wrong.
Yeah, my machine got knocked out. I'm sorry.
Oh, no problem. So yeah, so.
Yeah, I mean, we can't hear.
So yeah, I was saying that this entire process of ascent and integration is the evolutionary process which he has discussed so far from the viewpoint of universal nature. But it becomes individualized and then becomes a psychic process. The being's evolution is ascent and integration on an individual level. Of ascending, so the evolution of the psychic being is also an ascent, a gradual rise to higher stations of its own existence, and an integration in the sense of transformation of the nature components of the being in the key of that into which it has arisen.
So shall I start with?
So here, where we are right now, he is talking about the transition to the individual, to the human being, to man, because ultimately from the universal we move to the conscious individual process, because the entire double process of ascent and integration is one in which the one who has become many is realizing itself in each of these many as a total aspect of the one.
Now
So shall I start reading at page 717?
Okay.
But where is the limit of effectuation in the evolutionary being's self-becoming by self-exceeding? In mind itself, there are grades of the series, and each grade again is a series in itself. There are successive elevations, which we may conveniently call planes and subplanes of the mental consciousness and the mental being. The development of our mental self is largely an ascent of this stair. We can take our stand on any one of them, while yet maintaining a dependence on the lower stages and a power of occasional ascension to higher levels or of a response to influences from our being's superior strata. At present, we still normally take our first secure stand on the lowest subplane of the intelligence, which we may call the physical mental, because it depends for its evidence of fact and sense of reality on the physical brain, the physical sense mind, the physical sense organs. There we are the physical man who attaches most importance to objective things and to his outer life, has little intensity of the subjective or inner existence, and subordinates whatever he has of it to the greater claims of exterior reality. The physical man has a vital part, but it is mainly made up of the smaller instinctive and impulsive formations of life consciousness emerging from the subconscious, along with the customary crowd or round of sensations, desires, hopes, feelings, satisfactions, which are dependent on external things and external contacts and concerned with the practical, the immediately realizable and possible, the habitual, the common and average. He has a mental part, but this too is customary, traditional, practical, objective, and respects what belongs to the domain of mind mostly for its utility for the support, comfort, use, satisfaction and entertainment of his physical and sensational existence. For the physical mind takes its stand on matter and the material world, on the body and the bodily life, on sense experience and on a normal practical mentality and its experience. All that is not of this order. The physical mind builds up as a restricted superstructure dependent upon the external sense mentality. Even so, it regards these higher contents of life as either helpful adjuncts or a superfluous but pleasant luxury of imaginations, feelings and thought abstractions, not as inner realities, or even if it receives them as realities, it does not feel them concretely and substantially in their own proper substance. Subtler than the physical substance and its grosser concreteness, it treats them as subjective, less substantial extension from physical realities. It is inevitable that the human being should thus take his first stand on matter and give the external fact and external existence its due importance. For this is nature's first provision for our existence, on which she insists greatly. The physical man is emphasized in us and is multiplied abundantly in the world by her as her force for conservation of the secure, if somewhat inert, material basis on which she can maintain herself while she attempts her higher human developments. But in this mental formation, there is no power for progress or only for a material progress. It is our first mental status, but the mental being cannot remain always at this lowest rung of the human evolutionary ladder. So, does somebody else want to continue the next paragraph? Very fast. But he,
yeah,
he did say that too. But when it is wrong. Hmm?
Above physical mind and deeper within the physical sensation, deeper within than physical sensation, there is what we may call an intelligence of the life mind, dynamic, vital, nervous, more open, though still obscurely to the psychic
capable of a first soul formation, though only of an obscurer like soul. Not the psychic being, but a frontal formation of the vital Purusha. This life soul concretely senses and contracts the themes of the life world and tries to realize them here. It attaches immense importance to the satisfaction and fulfillment of the life being, the life force, the vital nature. It looks on physical existence as a field for the life impulse's self-fulfillment. For the play of ambition, power, strong character, love, passion, adventure, for the individual, the collective, the general human seeking and hazard and venture, for all kinds of life experiment and new life experience. And but for this saving element, this greater power, interest, significance, the physical existence would have for it no value. This life mentality is This life mentality is supported by our secret subliminal vital being and is in great contact with a life world to which it can easily open and so feel the unseen dynamic forces and realities behind the material universe. There is an inner life mind which does not need for its perceptions the evidence of the physical senses, is not limited by them. For on this level, our inner life and the inner life of the world become real to us, dependent of the body and of the symbols of the physical world, which alone we call natural phenomena. As if nature had no greater phenomena and no greater realities than those of gross matter. The vital man, molded consciously or unconsciously by these influences, is the man of desire and sensation, the man of force and action, the man of passion and emotion, the kinetic individual. He may and does lay great stress on the material existence, but he gives it, even when most preoccupied with its present actualities, a push for life experience, for force of realization, for life extension, for life power, for life affirmation and life expansion, which is nature's first impetus towards enlargement of the being. At the highest intensity of this life impetus, he becomes the breaker of bonds, the seeker of new horizons, the disturber of the past and present in the interest of the future. He has a mental life which is often enslaved to the vital force and its desires and passions, and it is this he seeks to satisfy through the mind. But when he interests himself strongly in mental things, he can become the mental adventurer, the opener of the way to new mind formations, or the fighter for an idea. The sensitive type of artist, the dynamic poet of life, or the prophet or champion of a cause. The vital mind is kinetic and therefore a great force in the working of evolutionary nature.
Okay, sorry. Okay, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, good.
So, can someone else read the next one?
Yes, I can read the next one. Above this level of vital mentality and at more inly extended is a mind plane of pure thought and intelligence to which the things of mental world are the most important realities. Those who are under its influence, the philosopher, thinker, scientist, intellectual creator, the man of idea, the man of written or spoken word, the idealist and dreamer are the present mental being at his highest attained summit. This mental man has his life path, his life of passions and desires and ambitions and life hopes of all kinds, and his lower sensational and physical existence. And this lower part can often equibalance or weigh down his nobler mental elements, so that although it is the highest portion of him, it does not become dominant and formative in his whole nature. But this is not typical of him in his greatest development. Further, the vital and physical are controlled and subjected by the thinking will and intelligence. The mental man cannot transform his nature, but he can control and harmonize it and lay on it the law of a mental ideal, impose balance or sublimating and refining influence, and give a high consistency to the multi-personal confusion and conflict, or the summary patchwork of our divided and half-constructed being. He can be the observer and governor of his own mind and life, can consciously develop them, and become to that extent a self-creator.
So, here we come to the point where we had stopped last time, and as we see, this is the transition from the universal evolution to a consideration of the human being, where this evolution becomes individualized. And here he is looking at the mind, because in the universal evolution of nature, there is an ascent that has taken place from matter through life and now into mind. And in the human being, this particular modality of mind becomes prominent. We have to look at these things from both the viewpoint of our own consciousness becoming aware or cognizant of these planes of consciousness in ourselves, but also from the viewpoint of a tapas of cosmic nature, of the cosmic Purusha, in each of its rungs of ascent. So the human being represents one such poise of the cosmic Purusha Shakti, you may say, where the mind consciousness is made the central being. Sri Aurobindo has the notion or concept of central being. Central being is also different in different beings, but at an evolutionary nature, each species has a central being, one may say, which is a kind of a focus of the cosmic Purusha at a certain level. For the human being, this is the mental consciousness. And so mind becomes properly the station from which the ascent to higher levels and the integration of the lower levels is to occur in the human being. Mind, therefore, has represented within itself those lower rungs by which it can achieve that integration. And this is why he points out that the grades and subgrades of mind include these levels of the physical and the vital within them. And then we move to a level which is more purely mental, which is rational, and which is idealistic, ideal, intellectual, etc. So we also see that this arising to a plane of consciousness which is mental brings a more total sense of self. A sense of self becomes fully focused with the arrival of true mental consciousness in the human being. And that is what allows individuality to emerge. Even before that, page 717, where we started, I'll read a few lines from the paragraph just before that, where he's saying, to climb to higher altitudes, to get a greater scope, to transform his lower nature, this is always a natural impulse of man as soon as he has made his place for himself in the physical and vital world of earth and has a little leisure to consider his further possibilities. Here it is that this general and universal process of ascent is becoming individualized in the human being. It must be so, not because of any false and pitiful imaginative illusion in him, but first, because he is the imperfect, still developing mental being and must strive for more development, for perfection, and still more because he is capable, unlike other terrestrial creatures, of becoming aware of what is deeper than mind, of the soul within him, and of what is above the mind, of supermind, of spirit, capable of opening to it, admitting it, rising towards it, taking hold of it. It is in his human nature, in all human nature, to exceed itself by conscious evolution, to climb beyond what he is. So this is the individual movement, and this movement has become individualized at the human level because of the arrival of mind and its full self-consciousness. But there is a reversal of the process that takes place then, as he says. It isn't as if cosmic nature is in a sort of universal way making the ascent, but individuals that have to make the ascent and then extend it into cosmic nature. That's how he presents it in the next line. Not individuals only, but in time, the race also. In a general rule of being and living, if not in all its members, can have the hope, if it develops a sufficient will, to rise beyond the imperfections of our present very undivine nature, and to ascend at least to a superior humanity, to rise nearer, even if it cannot absolutely reach to a divine manhood or supermanhood. So, so here we find that the process is also a process of the ascent of the soul, because the psychic being becomes fully what it is with the arrival of mind in the human being. We have discussed this point earlier. It is only in the human being that the fully individualized soul personality, the psychic being, makes its appearance. And that represents this transition to the individuation of the Supreme in the many. So now we come to this point where we can see how mind consciousness can turn its attention to the lower for the process of integration to take place, and then also turn above, higher, or within, deeper, to find the source of consciousness, either in the psychic or in the supermind, as he says, the soul or the supermind, and actually in both, because in a sense, it is the connection of the two that give stability to the transitioning human being.
Questions?
Shall we read the next paragraph?
Point, which relates to the last part of what Sitaram read. The mental man cannot transform his nature, but he can control and harmonize it and lay on it the law of a mental ideal, imposing a balance or a sublimating and refining influence, and give a high consistency to the multi-personal confusion and conflict or the summary patchwork of our divided and half-constructed being. He can be the observer and governor of his own mind and life, can consciously develop them, and become to that extent a self-creator. This is a very, very powerful two sentences, and it brings to sharp focus the advantages and disadvantages of the mind. The fact that it serves a purpose while we have it, we have to use it, and at the same time we need to know the limits of its office. The fact that it is not here to transform, that it cannot exceed its limitations, that in a sense, though it contains within itself certain representatives of matter or of the physical and of the vital, yet it can modify them by its principle, bring a certain kind of a kind of a relative degree of compromised harmony into them, of refining them, of bringing them a certain taming influence, but it cannot transform them. And there itself, it learns a certain degree of mastery in being able to observe and govern his own mind and life. It also gets a taste of the true mastery of the spirit, but it also realizes that it doesn't have this. And we touched on this earlier, that the whole history of civilization is in fact the uneasy compromise between the mind and the life. That in a sense, the mental being has always tended to exert its relative mastery on life, on what has been called on barbarism, but has never succeeded, has always been infected by it. Mind itself turns barbaric in its attempt to control the barbaric.
So can we say that to an extent modern scientific approach is bound by this failure?
Yes, undoubtedly. Because it also starts off with the same idealism. It starts off with the ideal that to know the world and to understand it fully, to understand its laws and processes, is to be able to create a greater world of perfection and comfort for the human being. Greater luxury, comfort, perfection, leisure in which to do things of a higher nature. But it doesn't achieve these things, because even as it tries to bring the world under its own taming influence, it gets infected with the desire to control, possess, and exploit. And that is the history of technology and science in the world. It has lent itself to the forces of greed, the forces of exploitation. And this is natural, because in a sense, either it ends up creating a sterile world, a moral world in which all the forces of the vital are denied, subjugated, suppressed, or it ends up creating a world in which it becomes infected by the hostilities of the vital.
Is that necessary though?
No, it is of course not necessary. We can find, human civilization, a history of civilization itself is witness to the fact that there are great moments of some kind of balance where there is a happy compromise, one may say, a happy sort of balance between the forces of the vital and the mental. where the idealisms of the mind have been accepted and given a certain shape by the forces of the vital. But these are usually of a temporary nature because of the fact that certain other aspects or elements both of mind and vital have not gone along for the ride. You know, they have been denied or suppressed. See, Greek civilization thrived on slavery, you know, and the subjugation of women. Indian civilization itself has had its own atrocities and had to devise a system in which the sannyasi split himself away from society. So, we've had relative degrees of success at best, but never something which is a true harmony. Because the spirit has not been able to lead, has not been given the function of the leader of both mind and vital.
Debashista, can you comment on, like, this is my take on modern art or the kind of art that has that is not aesthetically beautiful, like Paul Klee and all those people. So my take is that it's like a fall. It's a fall from the beauty and all the greater aspects of the mind. It's a fall into a very barbaric passion. Is that anything correct?
Well, what has happened really with the whole sort of movement of modern art is that there has been a questioning of the whole domain of aesthetics, of beauty. What has arisen as a result is something which may or may not look beautiful to us, but then it also asks the question as to what made us arrive at a certain standard of beauty. Beauty is also often a conditioning, because we are conditioned by certain, standards of beauty. That conditioning has come from society, that conditioning has come to some extent from even our own past, sort of background, exposure to what we consider beauty. Now, the question as to whether beauty, sense of beauty is innate to the human being, as to whether all of us will always perceive certain forms and, their relations as beautiful, is what has been questioned, very radically in modern art. One very interesting thing is that a lot of these things that immediately strike us as being quote-unquote ugly or unbeautiful, if one is exposed to them for long enough, and if one actually starts understanding the principles which have gone into their making, start revealing a power of beauty which is within them or behind them. It is at another level. It is as if something else has been, made the medium for beauty. This is true even in different cultures, because you find that a certain ideal of beauty, what you are kind of castigating, let's say, modern art for, say, Paul Klee for today, is what the whole Western tradition castigated Indian art for, even 100 years ago. There's a whole history of writing in the West where the whole sort of gamut of Indian art was seen as monstrous. So again, it's the same thing, and it was supposed that these people have no sense of aesthesis because they don't see the natural beauty that exists in shapes around them. They have to create multiple hands, arms, legs, etc. Only when the conceptual power behind it became accepted, then we saw that there's another ideal that is expressing, and suddenly it became tremendously beautiful and desirable. So that today no museum can do without a Nataraj or something like that. So again, these things have to be seen both from the point of view of our own conditioning and our own relative sort of exposure to what is the power of expression, as well as from the viewpoint of what the sort of movement of consciousness is in breaking forms and remaking forms.
Okay, thank you. Yes. The mind of pure intelligence hangs behind it, our inner or subliminal mind, which senses directly all the things of the mind plane, is open to the action of a world of mental forces, and can feel the ideative and other imponderable influences which act upon the material world and the life plane, but which at present we can only infer and cannot directly experience. These intangibles and imponderables are to the mental man real and patent, and he regards them as truths demanding to be realized in our or the earth's nature. On the inner plane, mind and mind-soul, independent of the body, can become to us an entire reality, and we can consciously live in them as much as in the body. Thus, to live in mind and to the things of the mind, to be an intelligence rather than a life and a body, is our highest position, short of spirituality in the degrees of nature. The mental man, the man of a self-dominating and self-formative mind and will, conscious of an ideal and turned towards its realization, the high intellect, the thinker, the sage, less kinetic and immediately effective than the vital man, who is the man of action and outer, swift life fulfillment, but as powerful and eventually even more powerful to open new vistas to the race, is the normal summit of nature's evolutionary formation on the human plane. These three degrees of mentality, clear in themselves, but most often mixed in our composition, are to our ordinary intelligence only psychological types that happen to have developed, and we do not discover any other significance in them. But in fact, they are full of significance, for they are the steps of nature's evolution of mental being towards itself exceeding. And as thinking mind is the highest step she can now attain, the perfected mental man is the rarest and highest of her normal human creatures. To go further, she has to bring into the mind and make active in mind, life and body the spiritual principle.
Vishishta, are you back online?
Yes. So in this last paragraph, he is pointing to the inner mind, as he calls it, the subliminal mind. So he's established three rungs of mind. And as he says over there, it seems sort of to be just a kind of a classification. But it's not just a meaningless classification, not just an exercise of the mind, but something very functional. three degrees of mentality, clear in themselves, but most often mixed in our composition, are to our ordinary intelligence only psychological types that happen to have developed. And we do not discover any other significance in them, but in fact, they are full of significance, for they are the steps of nature's evolution of mental being towards its self-exceeding. And as thinking man is the highest step she can now attain, the perfected mental man is the rarest and highest of our normal human creatures. And this is the whole sort of domain or vista opened up by the inner mind and the other mind planes which the inner mind gives access to. On the inner mind plane and mind soul, independent of the body, can become to us an entire reality. And we can consciously live in them as much as in the body. So then he goes on to talk about those new vistas that can be opened, ultimately in the short run, not as effective as what the doer, the active person can open up, but in the long run, even more powerful for the human race. And it points to that which is beyond it, which is the spiritual principle. To go further, she has to bring into the mind and make active in mind, life and body, the spiritual principle. So it points to that. It points to the fact that mind is constantly looking for the ultimate cause, for the law, the reason. And that if there is such a reason and law, it eludes it. It eludes it even if it puts a finger on it in terms of an understanding. It eludes it in practice. And that is what it yearns for. And in the inner mind, it starts coming into contact with this force, or with these forces that give it access to ultimately the power of spirit. The spiritual principle, as he calls it here.
What is this thing about full of significance? What is full of significance? Devashishtha, these three steps that he is talking about, this is the physical mind, vital mind and mental mind?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, these are the three steps.
Okay, in the last three paragraphs.
Degrees of mentality, yeah. As he says.
Yeah.
Can you explain those three steps, Devashishtha, once?
He has just explained, no, in the last three paragraphs which you read.
Oh, okay.
Those are the three steps.
Three degrees of mentality. Okay.
Right. Mm-hmm. Above the physical mind, and above the physical mind, the life mind, and then above the vital mentality, the pure thought and intelligence.
Okay.
These are the three steps. And then behind these three, the inner mind. The inner mind opening to other planes of consciousness, and to which all these influences are more real than what is real to our senses. So the mental world, one may say.
I was reading a commentary on the Chandogya Upanishad by Nolinida. So he was saying that there is a story that the Asura and Indra went to Brahma to ask about knowledge, and Brahma said, meditate on matter or annam. And then the Asuras are very happy and they think matter is Brahman, and they go back, and they are the ones who are the materialist or who believe in matter to be the supreme, and they have got stuck there. But Brahma keeps returning to
just one moment.
Yeah.
Let me try again.
Yeah.
Yes. So yeah, that's basically how I would answer your question. We can create monsters. We can also create human beings with some relative degree of difference. We can create enhanced human beings with certain other faculties. But we will not create a changed species which is a harmonious image of a blueprint which is beyond the human.
Mm-hmm.
Until and unless we find a consciousness which is beyond the human. Now, a supramental being tampering the human genome may be able to create a human being that exceeds the human. But the consciousness must first be that of somebody who has exceeded the human.
So, probably a little unrelated, but I remember reading from Sri Aurobindo that even if we as a species find ways of prolonging life, it may be that the psychic entity would find another way to exit than death when it is done with the body or the being for them.
Yes, and you're very right. In the Life Divine itself, he has a passageway talks about that. And then there is another very interesting place where he's talking about the prolongation of life and the human being in more humorous terms in a letter to Nirodha, where he points to this. I mean, you know there's also, I think it's either Aldous Huxley or Bertrand Russell who wrote his book called Back to Methuselah.
Mm-hmm.
Methuselah was a you know, biblical character who lived forever, you know, some incredible number of years, etc. But the problem was he had a human consciousness. And to live for thousands of years with a limited human consciousness is a curse. Because, you know, beyond a certain point, there is a certain kind of a stagnation of one's experience, power of experience. There is no expansion of the power of experience. The Indian counterpart of Methuselah is Yayati. Yayati, who wanted 1,000 years of pleasure. And at the end of it, he saw the total futility of it.
Yes, yes. Yeah, in fact, he is the one who exchanged youth with his son. Right? He gave old age to the son Puru Ravas, yes, is the person who's the lineage of the Kurus.
Yes.
And in the same, in the mental plane, Dr. Faustus made that mistake, right?
Yes.
Who is that?
Dr. Faustus did not want to live forever. He just wanted the sort of secrets of the universe while maintaining a human consciousness. He sold his soul to the devil to arrive at knowledge, at the fullness of knowledge. But why? It becomes the question. And for him it was power. Knowledge equates to power. You know, you develop individual power. It's a kind of aggrandizement, as he says. And what Sri Aurobindo is sort of calling the Nietzschean Superman here is that kind of being who acquires plenitude of knowledge for the sake of egoistic power.
And does he also meet with a sorry end?
Yeah, and there, of course, the whole Dr. Foster story is very heavily laced with biblical sort of, you know, retribution and all that. He suffers guilt and sin, and the devil takes his revenge, as it were. So he ends up, there are two versions. There is Christopher Marlowe's version, and there is Goethe's version. And in both of them, basically, he ends up possessed by the devil. So he... so-called selling his soul to the devil for power is, you know, the kind of parable of the expansion of the human ego to the point where it becomes possessed by powers beyond its control.
Mm-hmm.
It is no longer itself, but it is, you know, sort of a slave to, occult powers that are too grand
mm-hmm.
for it to have any control over. And they destroy it finally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the same reasons that Tantra has been asked or has been Sri Aurobindo has told not to practice Kriyas of Tantra.
Yeah. So, today let us come to a stop here. Unless you would like to read one more paragraph and start back again from there next time.
The spiritual man, shall I read the next
yes.
paragraph and we'll stop there?
Okay.
The spiritual man is the sign of this new evolution, this new and higher endeavor of nature. But this evolution differs from the past process of the evolutionary energy in two respects. It is conducted by a conscious effort of the human mind, and it is not confined to a conscious progression of the surface nature, but is accompanied by an attempt to break the walls of the ignorance and extend ourselves inward into the secret principle of our present being and outward into cosmic being as well as upward towards a higher principle. Up till now, what nature had achieved was an enlarging of the bounds of our surface knowledge ignorance. What it attempted in the spiritual endeavor is to abolish the ignorance, to go inwards and discover the soul, and to become united in consciousness with God and with all existence. This is the final aim of mental stage of evolutionary nature in man. It is the initial step towards a radical transmutation of the ignorance into the knowledge. The spiritual change begins by an influence of the inner being and the higher spiritual mind, an action felt and accepted on surface. But this by itself can lead only to an illumined mental idealism or to the growth of a religious mind, a religious temperament, and some devotion in the heart and pity in the conduct. It is a first approach of mind to spirit, but it cannot make a radical change. More has to be done. We have to live deeper within. We have to exceed our present consciousness and surpass our present status of nature.
At the end of the chapter.
This is a beautiful paragraph,
mm-hmm.
and we can start from next time with this paragraph. In a sense, we see that particular thing that he's saying about the spiritual change is what is active in our present times, in certain circles, this thing about the spiritual change begins by an influence of the inner being and the higher spiritual mind, an action felt and accepted on the surface. But this by itself can lead only to an illumined mental idealism or to the growth of a religious mind, a religious temperament, and some devotion in the heart and piety in the conduct. It is the first approach of mind to spirit, but it cannot make a radical change. This is something we see all around us today in all the various sort of, you know, idealisms that are going by the name of the New Age. These are the various, you know, directions of that idealism. Either it takes a certain kind of a religious turn, or it is taking a certain kind of a surface change, which is of an illumined mental idealism. But until and unless the aspiration goes deeper into the need for a radical change, a transformation of existence, it cannot go any further. So we can take this paragraph as our beginning point and return to it next time.
Thank you, Devashishta.
Thank you very much for doing this, Devashishta.
Thank you. Are you going to be in Delhi next time also?
Yeah.